So such beneficial attitude will not be found in the mind of any other human being. This is so because it is explained in verse number 24. In the case of sentient beings, even for themselves, they have never developed such a mind, even in the dream. So how could they develop such a mind for others? And in the case of others, they are unable to develop such a mind, even for themselves. So how could they develop? To others, therefore, development of such a precious mind is something amazing that one has never developed earlier. And it is amazing and it is extremely great that one is able to such a mind, which is the source of temporary benefit and long-term happiness, and this is really like a precious, incomparable, precious jewel, and which you are able to develop today, and which is something unthinkable, and which you never had before. Verse number 26. And this mind is in fact the cause of joy and happiness of all sentient beings, and it's kind of a remedy to remove the sufferings of all sentient beings. And and the merits that is being earned by the development of such a precious mind can never be measured, can never be fathomed. And this is a kind of a very special type of medicine or nectar that removes the sufferings of other sentient beings. Verse number 27. Merely by developing a wish to benefit others, it excels all other types of offerings to Buddhas. And if this is the case, then what need is there to talk about the great benefit of actually making effort or actually practicing to bring about the benefit and well-being of all other sentient beings. And in general, of course, making offerings to Buddhas have great benefit, as is said in one of the sutra called King of Meditative Stabilization Sutra. And in that King of Meditative Stabilization Sutra, it says that if you make offerings to the Supreme Beings, the Buddhas, if you make offerings, different types of offerings that fills the countless universes, and make these offerings daily to the Buddhas, and the merit earned by developing love and kindness to all sentient beings has more merit than the offerings that you would make in relation to the countless Buddhas. And by merely developing a wish to benefit others, said to excel the offerings to Buddhas, then what need is there to talk about actually working to help all sentient beings achieve enlightenment? Now here you might ask a question by saying that this may be true, but why is it necessary for me to take the responsibility to help all of the sentient beings? That since all sentient beings do not want suffering, that they all want happiness, they should make their own effort. Why I need to help them? And this is answered in verse 28 by saying that in the case of sentient beings, even though they have this wish to discard and remove the sufferings, but they rush and run towards sufferings. And in the case of happiness, even though they have the wish to have happiness, but because of ignorance, they destroy happiness as if they are enemies. And therefore, the sentient beings that are deprived of happiness and who possess manifold sufferings, in order to help them achieve the state of happiness and to make them satisfied with happiness and to eradicate all these sufferings and in order to dispel all types of ignorance and misconceptions. Such actions, there's no other virtuous actions which can compare such practices, and there is no spiritual friend comparable to this, and there is no merit that is equal to this. Because when you possess such a strong altruistic wish to help others and benefit others, then through that way you are not only able to remove the ignorance, but that also acts as an unchanging spiritual friend. In the case of ordinary friends, they can change and they are not reliable. And even in the case of a very trusted, unchanging friend, they are for one life and not for many lives. Whereas in the case of this beneficial attitude, like altruism, they are beneficial to you for many lives to come. And if you remove ignorance, if you remove self-cherishing attitude and the self-grasping attitude and develop altruism, then that will be the source of happiness and peace for oneself and for everybody else. So there is no friend that is comparable to this, and there is no merit that is comparable to this, because each and every moment you are earning merit having developed such an altruistic mind. Verse number 31. If you do some benefit, if you benefit some other people, and if that has been repaid, even that is said to be wonderful and praiseworthy. Now, if this is the case, what need is there to talk about? What need is there to talk about the good deeds done by the bodhisattvas who are not requested for such benefit, who are not requested for such help? And even without asking, the bodhisattvas help you to achieve not only temporary but long-term peace and happiness. And also in our ordinary case, if you undertake the practice of giving to some helpless or destitute sentient beings, and if you offer them not something very special food but some plain ordinary food, and also that food you do not give for a long time but for a short time, and also you give that not with genuine sincerity but very scornfully, and that also not for a long time but for a half day, even these are said appreciated by other people, saying that he is practicing virtuous deeds. Now, in this case, in terms of the object, it's inferior because the gift is given to limited number of people, and the food is not of good quality, it's a plain food, and the purpose is also not so much, it is only to fulfill their stomach just for half a day. And the actual practice of giving is also not healthy, because you undertake such a practice scornfully. Even such practices are appreciated and respected by saying that this is a virtuous practice. And if this is the case, then what need is there to talk about developing an L2 state wish, where you focus towards not just a limited sentient being, but countless sentient beings, and also in terms of time period, it's not for just a short time, but for a long time, and also in terms of purpose, it is not for a short purpose, but the purpose of achieving the supreme state of peace, the unsurpassing state of peace of enlightenment. So such a bodhicitta that fulfills one's own wishes, and then with that kind of altruistic wish, when you engage in such a giving, that can never be compared but any other practice. And also when such a bodhisattva practices the giving, he doesn't do it scornfully or contemptuously, but he does it by regarding all sentient beings as the as one's very dear and close friends. And as Nagarjuna has said, that one sees oneself as something that must be used by sentient beings, something that must be enjoyed by other sentient beings. So whether it's in terms of time, or in terms of motivation, or in terms of practice, they are all very unique and very special. So whether it is in terms of the object, in terms of the period, in terms of the actual practice, it is incomparable. So in terms of the practice of generosity or giving, there are so many ways of practicing it. There's practicing virtuous deeds, giving one's body, and giving material gifts, and so on. So this is the advantage and benefit of bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, in fact, has endless merits and benefits. Now, because of such great benefits of the bodhicitta, to such a bodhisattva who is really the benefactor, to such a bodhisattva, if you develop a very negative attitude, and if you try to interfere his practice and his way of life, and such a bodhisattva is also called a kind of benefactor, because he is someone who bestows upon all sentient beings the achievement of enlightenment. And to such a bodhisattva, if you develop ill will, or what to talk about, actually physically and verbally harming such a bodhisattva, but even mentally, if you develop some ill will, even if you develop slightest stress of negative mind towards such a bodhisattva, then equal to the number of the negative mind that you have generated, to that number you will be born into the hell.
Huh?
However, contrarily, if you develop a very pure mind towards such a bodhisattva, and the result of that will also be very special. And the result of, as a result of such a pure state of mind, equal to the number of the pure state of mind that you generate, your virtuous deeds will also particularly develop and multiply. And towards these giants of the Buddha, towards these bodhisattvas, even in great adversity, even when these bodhisattvas encounter in the case of these bodhisattvas, even when they encounter great adversity in the form of external and internal hindrances, which could be the sources for the event in the case of so whatever kind of adversities they encounter in terms of training their mind in bodhicitta and so on, these adversities will not be a source for developing negative emotions for purpose, but their virtuous deeds will naturally multiply. And therefore, I pay homage to such body that has generated and developed such a precious sublime mind of the bodhicitta, and I take refuge to that bodhisattva who is the source and origin of peace and happiness, to whom even if you harm them, we will make a relation to experience peace and happiness. So in the case of these bodhisattvas, even if you harm them, in result there will be peace and happiness. That is the story of Buddha being harmed physically, and later on, and in one of the lives, a yakshas, an evil spirit, harmed Buddha physically and sucking blood from his body. And as a result of this, making this connection, in one of the next lives, they were able to get certain positive benefits and experiences. So these are the advantages of practice of bodhicitta. So in this way you should understand the two types of bodhicitta and their individual benefits. This completes the first chapter, which discusses about the advantage of bodhicitta. And there are 10 chapters in this Bodhicaryavatara. The first is the chapter on advantages of bodhicitta. And when we develop bodhicitta, which has such advantages, first you develop aspirational bodhicitta, then you develop a wish to train the ways of life of bodhisattva and receive the bodhisattva vow at that point, and then you train in the six perfections, which are the ways of life of a bodhisattva, and then through development of kama abiding and special insight, finally you pass through the development of the five paths and the 10 grounds, and finally achieve enlightenment. In the second chapter, it explains the development of bodhicitta is explained in the third chapter, and as a preliminary to this practice, in the second chapter, explains about the practice of the seven limb practices. Having developed bodhicitta, you should lead the ways of Bodhisattva, which involves practice of the six perfections. And since practice of giving is found on many occasions, there is no special chapter on that. And in the case of training on morality, there are two chapters which are the chapters on conscientiousness and introspection. So there are two chapters which are means for purifying the method. Then we have separate chapter on the practice of patience, concentration and wisdom, and then finally the chapter on dedication. The actual visualization for the development of bodhicitta is explained in the 8th chapter, the chapter on concentration. And as a preliminary to this, you need to read the chapter on patience. So these two chapters, you should particularly study the chapter on patience and chapter on concentration. And then you should read the the chapter in the Precious Garland, which explains the process of development of bodhicitta. And according to the lineage instruction of the 10 chapters, according to Zapetu, he says he can, these 10 chapters of the Bodhicharya Avatara can be summarized into the four lines, the one verse, where we normally say that may I be able to develop the precious bodhicitta which we have not developed, and further enhance the bodhicitta that we have developed. So there are three particular lines of these four lines, which summarizes the contents of the 10 chapters from the Bodhisattva. The first line, to develop the bodhicitta that you have not developed, explains the first three chapters. The first three chapters are included in that. And then the second line, not to allow degenerate the bodhicitta that you have generated, explains the next three contents of the three chapters. And then the next three chapters, chapter on effort, concentration and wisdom, these are explained by the third line, which says may the bodhicitta that I have developed be further enhanced or further developed and prosper. And then finally we have the chapter on dedication, and this I think is a very relevant and related explanation, very suitable explanation. And when you are able to develop some experience of the bodhicitta, and then at that point through a ritual ceremony you should receive the bodhisattva vow. And if you receive the bodhisattva vow because of through a ritual ceremony, it will be more effective, because there will be the presence of the lama, and also certain rituals are performed, and because of these other factors it may make some more impact rather than meditating by oneself alone. For example, even you develop the aspirational bodhicitta, you are also making a commitment in front of the lama, so that will also help you to hold it more stable. Aspirational bodhicitta is a wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And if you limit your development only on that, then this is just an aspiration. And if you develop just such a level of state of mind, then there's no particular precept or commitment involved. On the other hand, if you develop an aspirational bodhicitta with a commitment, then first of all you develop such an aspiration, aspiring to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, and then you make a commitment by saying that I will never give up this mind. So if you develop such a mind, then you must observe the precepts, which is to maintain the four causes, which helps not to degenerate the bodhicitta that you have generated. So you should remove the four negative obstructions and develop the four virtuous practices. And similarly, you should study the precepts of Bodhisattva and then develop some wish to actually lead the ways of life of Bodhisattva. Because unless you lead the actual ways of life of Bodhisattva, your mere good wish in the form of aspiration of Bodhisattva will not be so effective. And in terms of actual training of the ways of life of Bodhisattva, it should primarily be a way of life or life which, where there is the combined practice of development of both method and wisdom. Because it is not enough just to have the method or just to have the wisdom. And when you develop such a strong aspiration to lead the ways of life of Bodhisattva, then you should receive the develop the Bodhisattva vow. And if there are no obstructions and hindrances, then you can receive the Bodhisattva vow from a lama. However, if there are certain risks to your life, or the lamas are not available, then you can receive the Bodhisattva vow from a holy image. Both in the case of development of aspirational bodhicitta and also the development of Bodhisattva vow, we need to purify negative deeds and collect merit, which is done through the seven limb practices. In order to develop that precious mind, I offer now to the Tathagatas, to the sacred Dharma, the stainless jewel, and to the sons of Buddha, the oceans of excellence. So this is the branch of making offerings. And the second verse, whatever flowers and fruits there are which are not owned by others. And similarly, whatever kinds of medicine. And similarly, all the natural jewels that exist in this world, and whatever clean, refreshing waters that exist. And also, when you refreshing water here means we should visualize not the waters that are found in salty seas and oceans, but clean, refreshing waters. Likewise, gem encrusted mountains, forest groves, quiet and joyful places, heavenly trees bedecked with flowers, and trees with fruit-laden branches. Fruit-laden branches means trees with fruits, and fragrance of the celestial realms, and incense, wishing trees, and jewel trees. And uncultivated harvests and all ornaments that are worthy to be offered. Lakes and pools adorned with lotuses, and the beautiful cry of wild geese, everything unowned within the limitless spheres of space. Creating these things in my mind, I offer them to the Supreme Beings, the Buddhas, as well as their sons. O compassionate ones, think kindly of me and accept these offerings of mine. Supreme Being refers to Buddhas, the Supreme of human beings, and the Bodhisattvas. Since you are the sublime object of offering, be compassionate and accept this offering. So these offering substances are limitless, so you can mentally visualize them, imagine them. And in the case of the objects that we possess, material objects that we possess, we have limited material objects to offer. Whereas in the case of flowers, trees, and so forth, so long as we are able to visualize, we can offer them to a limitless quality. And particularly in the case of Shantideva, who is the composer of the text, he was a simple yogi and he doesn't have much material facilities to offer. And therefore he is saying in this verse 7, having no merit, I am destitute and I have no other gifts to offer. O protectors, you who think of helping others, by your power accept this for my sake. And what you really possess is your body, and therefore he is saying that eternally shall I offer all my bodies to the conquerors. The Buddhas are also called conquerors because they have conquered over the four evil forces. So he makes this, makes the offering of his bodies to the conquerors and their sons. Please accept me, you supreme heroes. Respectfully shall I be your subject. So when Shantideva says, I may offer my body to you, he's saying that I am offering my body to sentient beings. And he is saying, respectfully shall I be your subject. And when you say, I let me be your subject, then he's saying that I will follow your comment, you will follow your rules and instructions. The rules and instructions of Buddha is not to harm others, to help sentient beings. And therefore helping others and not harming other sentient beings is not to please the Buddha, and therefore for the benefit of mother sentient beings, one should commit oneself until to the end of the limit of the space, that one should continuously keep on helping other sentient beings. Through being completely under your care, I shall benefit all with no fears of conditioned existence. I shall perfectly transcend my previous evils and in the future shall commit no more. And one will be perfectly able to transcend one's evils by developing the view of emptiness and by removing the self-cherishing attitude. And in this way, when you do not let yourself be controlled by self-cherishing attitude and self-grasping, there is no one within the samsara, there will be no sentient being who will be able to harm you. And that's why he is saying that I shall benefit all with no fears of conditioned existence. And I shall perfectly transcend my past evils. One transcends one's past evils by regretting the past negative deeds. And in the future, I shall commit no more. That means you restrain yourself from committing negative deeds. And next is giving the bath. So then it explains about 12 offerings. The first is offering the bathhouse to very sweetly scented bathing chambers with brilliantly sparkling crystal floors and exquisite pillars ablaze with gems, having canopies above aglow with pearls. So you imagine or visualize such a bathing house. And you offer bath to Tathagatas and their sons, and therefore I beseech the Tathagatas and their sons to come and bathe their bodies from many drilled vases filled with waters, scented and enticing, to the accompaniment of music and song. And let me dry their bodies with incomparable clothes, clean and well anointed with scent, and then may I present these holy beings with fragrant garments of suitable clothes. And so first we give the bath, and then dry their bodies, and then offer the garments or costumes, and to the monks or sanghas, I adorn with manifold ornaments and various raiments, fine and smooth. And to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are in the form of a lay person, to them you offer various raiments, fine and smooth. The Aryas, Samantabhadra, Manjukosha, Avalokiteshvara, and all the others. And to Samantabhadra, Manjukosha, Avalokiteshvara, who are in the form of a god, to them you offer just like polishing pure refined gold, do I anoint the Buddha's forms that ablaze with light, with the choicest perfumes whose fragrance permeates 1,000,000,000 worlds. And next is offering flowers, and to the highest objects of giving, I offer beautiful, well-arranged garlands, as well as enchanting, sweet-smelling flowers, such as lily, jasmine, and lotus blossoms. And then also I send forth cloths of incense, whose sweet aroma still savors the mind, as well as celestial delicacies, including a variety of foods and drinks. I offer them jeweled lamps arranged on golden lotus buds. Upon land sprinkled with scented water, do I scatter delicate flower petals. To those who have the nature of compassion, I offer palaces resounding with melodious hymns, exquisitely illuminated by hanging pearls and gems that adorn the infinities of space. Eternally shall I offer to all the Buddhas jeweled umbrellas with golden handles and exquisite ornaments and embellishing the rims, standing erect, their shapes beautiful to behold. So this tenth offering is the offering of the umbrella. The 11th offering is the offering through the power of prayers, and in addition, may a mass of offerings resounding with sweet and pleasing music, like clouds that appear the misery of, like clouds that appease the misery of all, each remain for as long as necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And next 12th offering is, and may a continuous rain of flowers and precious gems descend upon the reliquaries and the reliquaries here means stupas. There are many different types of stupas. There are 8 different types of stupas in relation to 8 different life events of the Buddha and so on, and the statues, and upon all the jewels of Dharma. Next is offering the unsurpassing offering. In the same way as Manjukosha and others have made offerings to the conquerors, similarly do I bestow gifts upon the Tathagatas, the protectors, their sons, and all. Next is the offering of speech, offering of harmonious praise and verbal homage. I glorify the oceans of excellence with limitless verses of harmonious praise. May these clouds of gentle eulogy constantly ascend through their presence. So these harmonious praises are done not for the sake of poetic beauty, but actually praising the actual qualities of the Buddha. With Bodhis, next is physical homage with Bodhis as numerous as all the atoms within the universe. I approached it to all Buddhas of the three times, the Dharma and the Supreme Community. So here you are prostrating to all Buddhas of the three times, and similarly the Mahayana Dharma and the Mahayana Sangha, the Supreme Community, for the sake of achieving enlightenment. And in order to achieve enlightenment, you prostrate to the Buddha, Dharma and the Sangha, imagining that your bodies are as numerous as all the atoms within the universe. Likewise, I prostrate to all reliquaries, the basis of an awakening mind of Bodhicitta, and to all planet abodes and masters, and to all the noble practitioners. And here you pay homage to all worthy, all those that are worthy of respect, like learned abbots and masters who had helped you to achieve novice monk ordination or bhikshu ordination and so on, and similarly to all the noble practitioners who have led a life that conforms to the conduct of a Mahayana practitioner. And next is the branch of confession in which first you take refuge, which is one of the four antidotal powers. The first is the power of the object. I seek refuge in all Buddhas until I possess the essence of awakening. Likewise, I seek refuge in Dharma and in the assembly of Bodhisattvas. And with the actual confession, you are saying, with folded hands, I beseech the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who possess the great compassion and decide on in all directions. Now, with regard to this practice of confession, this is the general confession. And so this is the power. Next is the power of repudiating the negative deeds. By saying that throughout beginningless cyclic existence, in this life and in others, unknowingly I committed evil deeds and ordered them to be done by others. Unknowingly means because of lack of knowledge, you might have personally committed evil deeds, and also you might have asked others to commit such evil deeds. And so whatever negative deeds that I've done, I now see the negative deeds as negative deeds and repent for them, overwhelmed by the deceptions of ignorance. I rejoiced in what was done, but now seeing these mistakes from my heart, I declare them to the Buddhas. The Tibetan word for confession is called shakwa, which actually means to open up, just like when you chop a tree and open it up. Similarly, you open up your heart and declare your negative deeds without hiding any of them. And whatever harmful acts of body, speech and mind I have done in a disturbed mental state towards the three jewels of refuge, my parents, my spiritual masters and others. So here what you are saying is motivated by negative emotion, physically, verbally and mentally, I must have done many negative things with a disturbed state of mind towards the holy objects, the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, who are the special objects of quality, and then your parents, who are object of kindness and compassion, and your spiritual masters and others. Done by me so thoroughly evil and polluted, but in abundance of faults I openly declare to the guides of the world. The reason why you should make such a confession is unless you confess and purify those negative deeds, unless you purify your negative deeds, there is a possibility that you might die before you are able to purify and confess these negative deeds. But I may well perish before all my evils have been purified, so please protect me in such a way as will swiftly and surely free me from them. So what you are saying is that while I am alive, by employing the four antidotal powers, may I be able to purify all the negative deeds from the depth of my heart by clearly recognizing the destructive effects of negative emotions. And therefore, from the depth of my heart, I would like to purify them kindly, quickly, help me. Now, if you die before purifying negative deeds, what are the risks, what are the danger? This is explained in verse 33 by saying that in the case of the death, as we discussed earlier, there is no definiteness of time. The untrustworthy Lord of Death waits not for things to be done or undone, whether it's a spiritual practice or a worldly activity. The Lord of Death will not see whether you have completed your job or not. They will not wait for you, and therefore they are not trustworthy. Whether I am sick or healthy, this fleeting lifespan is unstable, and you might die suddenly. And at the time of the death, whether it's your body or wealth or your relatives and friends, and even your body, all of this you leave behind, as is explained in verse 34. Leaving all, I must depart alone. But through not having understood this, I committed various kinds of evil just for the sake of this very short life, for the sake of my friends with whom I have great friendship and association, and the foes or enemies with whom I have great hatred. So mentally, verbally and physically, you might have developed many negative deeds like hatred, competitiveness, jealousy and so on. So we keep on committing such negative deeds. So for the sake of your friends and foes, you committed many types of negative deeds. But if you reflect carefully, these friends and foes in relation to which you have committed negative deeds, they will soon disappear and they will soon become non-existent. My foes will become non-existent, my friends will become non-existent, and I too will become non-existent. Likewise, all will become non-existent. So whether it's your enemies, which you dislike very much, or it's for your friends, which you like very much, and even yourself, in relation to which friends and foes are distinguished, all of these will become non-existent, and likewise all will become non-existent, meaning all here means your enjoyment, wealth and everything that will become non-existent. Just like a dream experience, whatever things I enjoy will become a memory. Whatever has passed will not be seen again. It's like a dream that you had tonight. And if you get a dream tonight, and next morning when you get up, it's just a memory, and the suffering experiences that you had during the dream, they are all now non-existent. They can never be reversed back. They can never be invited back. They are just an object of memory. Similarly, your body, enjoyment, wealth, and relatives, every day, with the passage of every year, every month, every day, every hour and minute, disappear and become just object of memory. And all these conditioned phenomena are transient and changing all the time. And whatever has passed will not be seen again. So right from the time when the world is formed and until now, whatever has happened can never be repeated. They have changed and they disintegrated and they are non-existent. And even in the case of this very life, even within this brief life, many friends and foes have passed. During our, say, depending upon your age, you may be 20, 30, 40, 60, 70, 80, and so on. Now, if you look back about your acquaintances, those who may be your friends or enemies or those that are neutral to you, if you reflect about them, you will find many of them already have passed and died. And now even if you go throughout the world to bring these people back, you will not be able to do so. So in this way, some of your friends and foes passed. However, the virtuous deeds and negative deeds, virtuous deeds and negative deeds for the friends and foes for which you have committed many virtues and negative deeds that you have committed, all these friends and foes have gone and passed. However, all the negative deeds that you have committed in relation to these friends and foes, they are still there with you. So that is what is explained in the next two lines. But whatever unbearable evil I committed for them remains ahead of me. Remains ahead of me means the fruits, the sufferings of these negative deeds are yet to come. Thereby, through not having realized, through not knowing that I shall suddenly vanish, I committed so much evil out of ignorance, lust and hate. And either due to lack of knowledge or because of due to laziness, you committed many negative deeds. And this is all because you have not realized that you are transient, perishable, and you have therefore developed attachment, lust, and so on towards your friends, and you try to guard your friends, relatives, and yourself. And in the case of enemy, you developed hatred, even including backbiting, and all these negative emotions you have committed, and they are ready to bear their fruits. And as and when they encounter the activating forces, they are ready to bear their fruits. So in this way, when you have committed such negative emotions, and when you have committed so many evil actions, which are ready to bear the fruits in the form of an evil existence and so on. While in that state, day and night goes on without waiting for you, remaining neither day nor night, life is always slipping by, never getting any longer. Why will death not come to one like me? And in the case of your life, there's no way you can multiply it. At the time of the death, while I'm lying in bed, ready to die, all those surrounded by my friends and relatives, the feeling of life being severed will be experienced by me alone and cannot be shared by your friends and relatives. For example, when you experience terrible illness, none of your very close friends can share their suffering. Even if your friends and relatives lament and cry and embrace you, but there is no way that they can share your sufferings and your lamentations. And therefore, the feeling of your life being lost will be experienced by only you. The feeling of life here means at the time of the death, the four, five elements get extremely disturbed and you get different visions and appearances, frightful experiences, and such intense and frightening experiences will have to be experienced by oneself alone and cannot be shared by others. And so all the pains and problems that you experience in your life, in generally speaking, cannot be shared by others, and particularly the pains of death cannot be shared by others. And finally, leaving your friends and relatives, even your spouses and partners and your teachers, all you have to leave all this behind. And when seized by the messengers of the death, what benefits will friends and relatives afford? Even the Buddha will be of no benefit in that case. And there is the story of conflict that happened at the time of the Buddha. And, when the gods were chased by demigods, and then three children, young children, came to the protection of the Buddha. And it is said that Buddha hid them, one amidst mountain, one under his begging bowl, and like that. And then later on, when everyone else had been killed in the war, and later on when those that are supposed to be under the protection of the Buddha, it is said that they also were found dead, because they have committed the same karma. So that's why we normally, there is a saying which says that at the time of the death, even if you have your head on the lap of the Buddha and protected by the Vajrapani as the guardian and so on, you cannot be protected by the Lord of the Death, the ripening of the karma. And at the time of the death, what is beneficial is if you have committed some merit, if you have some force of virtuous deeds, my merit alone shall protect me then. But upon that, I have never realized That means at that time it will be very difficult for you to find a powerful virtuous deed which you can confidently say and recall and think that this will help. Okay, so very in a big mess, you know, you are in great difficulty. Therefore, you are now in one of the protectors. All protectors, I so careless, unaware of such terror as this, accumulated a great deal of evil for the sake of this short life, this transient life. You accumulated a great deal of evil in the form of exploiting others, deceiving others, and slaving others. By in this way, you have used human intelligence in the wrong way. And today in this world, we can see that human beings do possess intelligence, but intelligence is generally used in the wrong way. And because of that, I do feel that sometimes in the case of some animals, like even more ferocious animals like tiger, lions and so on, when they are fed, then they do not disturb other animals. They live together. When they are hungry, then they just chase and pounce upon one of other animals and eat them. But otherwise, they will not pounce and kill. Whereas in the case of human beings, we are not satisfied with just being able to get something to eat, but we are involved in economics or politics, competitiveness, jealousy, and within one family, we need to take care of ourselves at the individual level, and then family level, then the level of the society, and so on. And therefore, we lead a very sophisticated life with very sophisticated conceptual thoughts and intelligence. And therefore, if you think carefully, it is really terrifying. There is no way you can relax. And this is explained in the verse 43. Petrified is a person today being led to a torture chamber with a dry mouth and dreadful sunken eyes. His entire appearance is transfigured. Now, if this is the case, what need to mention the tremendous despair when stricken with the disease of great panic, being clasped by the physical forms of the frightful messengers of death? So in the first verse 43, it's giving an example saying that even if you are to be executed and led to torture chamber, then you get so petrified and terrified that your mouth become dry and your eyes sink and your entire changes. If this is the case, then there's no need to talk about the fright that you will experience when you will be visited by the messenger of death. That means when you actually encounter death. And who can afford me real protection from this great horror? And with terrified, bulging eyes, agape, I shall search the four quarters for refuge, looking for somebody who will be able to protect you, who will be able to help me from those horror, from those terrifying experiences. The actions that you have accumulated, its fruits you will be able to experience, you have to experience. And therefore, but seeing no refuge there, because one has to experience the result of one's own karma, therefore you find no refuge there, and therefore you shall become enveloped in gloom and despair. If there should be no protection there, then what shall I be able to do? And particularly if you are born as a hell being and so on, then there's no way that any protector can be able to help you. However, provided if you have certain positive habituations and so on, and thereby if you're able to develop certain positive attitudes, this might help you. Otherwise, there will be no help. And who are the real protectors? The real protectors are your virtuous deeds. And among the virtuous minds, the most important is the altruistic mind, the mind of Bodhicitta. And as soon as you develop such an altruistic mind or Bodhicitta, even if you were already born into a negative state of existence, you will immediately be relieved from such sufferings. And even if you have to abide there in that state of negative existence, still you can shorten the time. So therefore, the actual refuge has to be cultivated within one's mind. And apart from that, no external protectors can protect you. And therefore, I now seek refuge in the Buddhas who protect and who strive to shelter all that lives and with the great strength eradicate. Has conquered over the four evil forces, and he is of the world because he possesses the great compassion, and who is strength to protect the sentient beings, and who can provide the shelter. He himself is the one who possesses strength and who possesses power. And in this way, if you are able to develop a strong devotion and faith in this way, you can get liberated from fear. And when once your mind is free from fear, then you will be able to develop positive qualities. And therefore, Buddha is someone who himself fears, and who is skillful in liberating other sentient beings. And therefore, likewise, purely seek refuge in the Dharma they have realized, the Dharma that the Buddhas have realized, and that clears away the fears of cycle existence, and also in the assembly of Bodhisattvas. So in short, you are taking refuge to the Bodhicitta and the view of emptiness. Taking refuge to Bodhicitta and the view of emptiness means to make one's mind habituated with such practices and to develop such qualities. I, trembling with fear, offer myself to Samantabhadra. And in the case of the eight close disciples, the eight bodhisattvas, it seems that they have special powers because of their motivation and because of their blessings and because of their past prayers. It seems all these bodhisattvas have special capacities and special powers. So therefore here also you are making all those powerful prayers and confessing your negative deeds. So therefore here you are saying, I trembling with fear offer myself to Samantha Bhadra and to Manju Gosha also, I make a gift of my body. When you say I make a gift of my body, you are saying that I am doing so with my own choice and not being forced by others. To the protector of Avalokiteshvara, who infallibly acts with compassion, I utter a mournful cry, please protect this evil door. In my search for refuge, I cry from my heart for Akash Garba, Shiti Garba, and all the compassionate protectors. And I seek refuge in Vajrapani, upon the sight of whom all harmful beings, such as the messengers of death, flee in terror to the four quarters. In the past, I transgressed your advice, but now, upon seeing this great fear, I go to you for refuge. By doing so, may this fear be swiftly cleared away. If I need to comply with the doctor's advice, when frightened by a common illness, then how much more so when perpetually diseased by the manifold evils of desire and so forth. Now this means that even when you suffer from a physical illness, you get frightened by it and you immediately go to a doctor for his advice and treatment. And then this, if this is the case, then what need is there to talk about having to rely on the physician like enlightened Buddhas to completely remove the countless or manifold evils of the mind, the manifold effect of emotions. In the case of the mental emotions, mental thoughts and conceptions are infinite, and similarly the afflictive emotions are infinite. Now in the case of physical illness, if it is through a wrong usage of food and so on, then sometimes you get ill and sometimes you get well. Now in the case of internal illness, particularly like the three poisons, attachment, hatred and anger, it is not the case that they are with you sometimes and not there on other occasions. They are always there with you. So therefore you are perpetually diseased by these manifold afflictive emotions. And therefore, one definitely has to rely on the teaching of the Buddha. And if all people dwelling on this earth can be overcome by just one of these afflictive emotions, and if no other medicine to cure them is to be found elsewhere in the universe. Now, in this world, if there is a terrible disease, then suddenly you announce saying that one should be careful, that such and such epidemic diseases are there, even though there is it is not sure and no guarantee that this disease will affect everybody. Whereas in the case of afflictive emotions, not only human beings, all sentient beings, including the tiniest insects, are suffering from this illness. And in the case of illnesses like attachment and hatred, not only this will bring suffering upon the individual person, but this will bring destruction and suffering among the people of the whole world. And particularly, in addition to the afflictive emotions, when we have access to such sophisticated destructive machines, there is the risk of the whole world being destroyed. So therefore, and if all people dwelling on this earth can be overcome by just one of these, so one of these afflictive emotions has the power to destroy the whole world. And the only remedy, the only medicine that can cure such an illness, such a disease, is the altruistic, so meaning that you need a medicine which can counteract against self-cherishing attitude and and against the self-grasping. And then the intention not to act in accordance with the advice of the all-knowing physicians, that means Buddha, that can uproot every misery, is extremely bewildered and worthy of scorn. And therefore, not to listen to the advice of such an omniscient Buddha is totally out of ignorance. If I need to be careful near a small ordinary precipice, then how much more so near the one of long duration that draws for 1,000 miles. It is inappropriate to enjoy myself thinking that today alone I shall not die, or probably I will not die next month or next year. This is not, because of short-sightedness. As we discussed, death is definite and the time of death is indefinite, and therefore this is the time to work hard and to undertake the spiritual practice, for inevitably the time will come when I shall become nothing. Who can grant me fearlessness? How can I be surely freed from this? If I shall inevitably become nothing, how can I relax and enjoy myself? You should not let yourself overpowered by such afflictive emotions. And unless you make an effort to put an end to these afflictive emotions and thereby gain control over the enemy of afflictive emotions, there is no other way by which you can free yourself from such afflictive emotions. If I shall inevitably become nothing means that it's definite that I will die, therefore how can I relax and enjoy myself? Next is the antidotal power of refraining from negative actions in the future. What remains with me now from the terminated experience of the past, but through my great attachment to them, I have been going against my spiritual master's advice. Having departed from this life and from all my friends and relatives, if all alone I must go elsewhere, what is the use of making friends and enemies? So whether it's object of attachment or objects of hatred, none of them can accompany you. How can I be surely freed from non-virtuous deeds, the source of misery, continually night and day? Should I only consider this, meaning that you should think about action and their result? Whatever has been done by me through ignorance and unknowing, be it the breaking of a vow or a deed by nature wrong, I humbly confess it all in the presence of the protectors with folded hands, prostrating myself again and again, my mind terrified the misery to come. I beseech all the guides of the world to please accept my evils and wrongs. Since these are not good, in future I shall do them no more. So here what you are confessing is confessing the natural negative deeds as well as the prohibited deeds. So you are confessing all these negative deeds before or in the presence of the protectors, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And in the final words you are saying that I now realize that all the evils and wrongs that I've committed are definitely not good, and therefore in future I shall not do them. and therefore you are requesting the liberators. To be compassionate on them and to bear with their negative deeds. And you are saying that be compassionate and listen to me, that I would like to confess all these negative deeds that I've done, and I now realize that these are not good and I will not commit them in the future. And you are making a commitment saying that I will restrain from committing such negative deeds in the future. So this completes the second chapter. Stop here today. Majibonam jinjur jingje bonyam bame bayakun lekudanangayoo.